Hey, I'm Danielle Carmanis, and I'm so happy you're here. Welcome back to Karma Has Spoken. Have you ever been lost in your thoughts or been told it's all in your head? Do you wonder how the brain works and how to make it work well for you? We have one of the world's leading experts on the brain with the answers later in the show. We'll cover everything from anxiety to brain fog to cures for ALS and Alzheimer's. But first, have you ever had a long day where you crave a cozy bed surrounded by all of your favorite things? Maybe your idea of a perfect night is curling up with a book or dinner with friends. For teens fighting life-threatening diseases, the chance to feel safe and normal can seem like a far-fetched dream. Our next guest is making dreams come true. She is an executive and mom on a mission to create experiences that allow every teen the chance to be a kid. I am so inspired by her story. Nancy Sovereign is the executive director of Wish Upon a Teen. Hi, Nancy.
Hi, good morning. Thanks for having me.
Thank you for being here. So how did this all begin? I want to know, what is Wish Upon a Teen and how did you become involved?
Well, I became involved because I was a parent of a child facing a severe medical illness. 7 years ago, our daughter, our seventh child, Hope, was in Mott Hospital in Ann Arbor and needed a bone marrow transplant. And so being away from family and friends and her school was very difficult. So Wish Upon a Teen received a referral from the Child Life staff. They came out one day and they designed her hospital room, turned it into everything that Hope loved in life and that comfy bed that you were talking about. And then I became a volunteer. And then I became...
And you have nine kids,
I have
by
nine
the way.
Kids, right? Seven girls and two boys.
Okay.
And then I became their community development specialist, and it grew from four hospitals to 75 hospitals across the United States. And then I became the executive director 5 years ago.
So what has that experience been like for you, seeing the growth of the organization?
It's been amazing. You know, there's so many teens out there that need our support, and we're the only nonprofit in the United States that deals solely with teenagers. Any diagnosis, which kind of sets us apart. We help teens with any diagnosis who are in the hospital 2 weeks and longer. And being on that, I have been on that other side as a parent. I see the impact, and I know what these families are going through. And to try to make a difference, try to put my pain that my family has gone through and my daughter has gone through into a purpose bigger than us.
So since you've been working with your organization, what has your most memorable experience been?
Well, it was just recently. We went in and did a room for a young man, Tommy, at Mott Hospital. He wanted his theme done in Pistons and Lions. And I love when they pick the Detroit theme teams. And we have had so many of the sports athletes reach out and do rooms with us. Well, one of our friends had reached out to Sam Martin for the Lions, and Sam donated a bunch of stuff for Tommy's room, and as well, the Pistons did as well. And I went in and decorated his room, and I said, you know, Sam said, if you want to come to a Lions training camp, you know, you can come. So the week later, Tommy texted me, and he said, Nancy, my doctors think if I can get out tomorrow for a day pass, would Sam, you know, could I go to training camp? And I'm like, I'm on it.
Right.
And so I got a hold of Sam's friend, and Sam got a hold, you know, and Sam's like, absolutely, he can come. And he made, you know, this day, Tommy got out of the hospital at 9:30 in the morning for the day with his dad and his best friend. And they went and they treated him, you know, it was the week the New England Patriots were here.
Which could really go any which way, right?
Yeah. I know. So, the team, you know, Matt Stafford, Sam, the new players, and a lot of the players just were wonderful to him. And that experience gives them that hope and that support to get through that round of chemo that he was going. He was supposed to go to Michigan State as a freshman. Mm. He had had a heart transplant 9 years ago and ended up 2 months ago getting sick with, I think it's post-transplant lymphoma, which is rare, but it can happen because they're on those immunosuppressant drugs. Mm. So here he's supposed to be, you know, being a freshman at Michigan State, and he's in laying in a bed, you know, fighting for his life every couple of weeks with chemo treatments. Mm. It's you know, heartbreaking. But when moments like that happen, like the Lions training camp, I'm like, yes.
Oh, well, you're such an amazing advocate, and using your own experiences to then, you know, create these experiences for these teens. It's just, you're giving them hope. And, you know, with hope, that keeps them moving forward, right? It gives them something to go toward. You know, for people who are listening, who want to help, who want to get involved, how can they do that? And what types of volunteers are you looking for? Are you looking for resources, money, time?
Well, kind of all of it. We are looking for sponsors all the time, for people to sponsor or design my room. I would love for you just to come one time with me to watch and help design a room. You would love it and see the impact, because you'll walk in this room and it's a dark room. The blinds are closed. And I can remember when my daughter had her bone marrow transplant, her doctor, her oncologist said, make the days, the nights, the nights. And so as soon as I go in to design the rooms, my signature move is I pull up the blinds. Mm. And then I make the room, you know, and then when they come in, you know, they're kind of, you know, they're sad. You go into this room, it's dark, they're under their blankets, and they're missing life.
Yeah.
And you go in and you transform their room, and the giggle that they do when they come to their door, because they usually like to be surprised, so they'll go for a walk. And they come, and it's
so important, and it truly is so powerful to create that environment. And this is, you know, not the same experience at all, but when I was pregnant with my twins and I had 3 months of bed rest, and, you know, I was told early on, I was hospitalized and told they probably wouldn't survive, but they're putting me on bed rest. And it was, of course,
stressful
and a horrible thing to put in my head. And I remember laying in the hospital bed, and I had just changed doctors and getting all my might and looking those doctors in the eyes and saying, no, these babies will survive. And they laughed at me. And, you know, I didn't know anything about bed rest. And I thought, it kind of sounds like the dream, right? You get to just lay in bed and watch TV for 3 months and sign me up. But it's not that. And I tell people all the time, it is physically and mentally the hardest challenge I've ever been through. So for me in that experience, I was fighting for the lives of my babies. And when you're talking about those teens, it just, I feel it so deeply in my heart. They're fighting for their lives. And they can't get out. They don't have control. There's so little that they have control of. And I so appreciate these from my own experiences, again, which is not the same, but I so appreciate these experiences that you're creating, that it doesn't just give them hope. It's creating something almost bigger than hope as we know it, right?
Absolutely.
That's really changing their lives and giving them the courage and the strength to be healthy. So for people who are listening who want to volunteer, and I really hope they do, because I think it's so important, and the way you've grown this organization and navigated the bureaucracy of growing a nonprofit, which is
it's cumbersome.
Really, really tough to do,
it's
right?
It's cumbersome. And we have a prom every year that we have 154 teens come to also that haven't been able to go to their prom. And that's one of the things in life that, you know, when you're a teenager, you remember those dances in life, and they should be able to say whether they want to go or not. Mm. So we even send Ubers to the hospital to bring them to prom. And so it's just been an amazing, and we had our last one at the Imagine Entertainment and Children's Hospital of Michigan as one of our biggest supporters.
Oh,
Lorraine
Wald.
Yes, she comes every year. She just won an award, our Teen Champion Award, because she is a champion for our teens.
She
and we
is.
Couldn't do it without the support. They have been our supporter for our prom for the last 7 years.
Oh,
and so
I'm going to send her a note today,
yeah.
And I hope her ears are burning. She's just absolutely one of my favorite people.
She is. She's a gem. And
she is, right?
She's a true gem.
She's brilliant. She has such a big heart.
And she's good with her staff as well. Mm-hmm. I mean, she's really passionate about the families, but also her staff, which I just think is admirable.
I always say she's a unicorn. She's just one of those amazing, dynamic, strong women
really
who are supportive
good analogy, yes.
of other women, right?
Absolutely.
She's so encouraging,
absolutely.
So supportive. She's a great girlfriend. We've done a few girls' trips, and she's so much fun.
Oh,
so if you have a chance, go out with her.
She's amazing. But, you know, you can visit our website at wishuponateen.org. There's ways to get involved if you want to volunteer, if you want to donate, whatever. We're a small nonprofit, but we've got a big foot in the community and just making a difference one teen at a time. And I'm so proud of, like, you know, I'm making my message, you know, I'm kind of, that's what I'm doing. And I'm so honored and blessed to be able to do it. And thank you for having me today.
Well, and I know there's so much talent among everyone listening, right? And with resources
absolutely.
And ideas and the moms who are listening, I mean, this is what we do as moms, right? We're planning things for our kids every day and using some of their brain power and putting it towards these events and the rooms. I mean,
absolutely.
It would just be so great to have the resources. So tell us again where they can...
wishuponateen.org. You can contact me through there, or Nancy at wishuponateen.org. They can email me. That would be wonderful.
Okay. Thank you for stopping by, Lucy.
Thank you for having.
I love chatting with you.
I know
you.
This is very cute here. Thank you for having me.
Thank you. All right. Well, you'll have to come back.
I will. Thank you.
Have you ever felt like your mind is racing? And is laughter actually the best medicine? Well, I'm sitting with a superhero who actually knows the answers to these questions. She's a leading neurologist and neuroscientist in the world, an expert on ALS, and she's leading her own team of 30 scientists in innovative and groundbreaking research that will someday save the life of someone you love. She has an MD, PhD, and she's past president of the American Neurological Association. She is a real-life Wonder Woman who is using her own brilliant brain to save each of ours. I am so thrilled to welcome one of my favorite girlfriends, Eva Feldman.
Oh, thank you, Danielle.
Well, it's such a treat to have you here. Eva, so we've been girlfriends for a long time.
We have.
And you're
5 years.
5 years. And you're brilliant. And you know, I mean, I just want to cover everything about the brain. I want to get inside of your brain. As you know, I have questions for you all the time with everything. I feel like I call you if I have a stubbed toe and ask you if I'm going to live. And generally the answer is yes, you will live. A little earlier, we were talking about breakfast. I had a banana and peanut butter with a little bit of honey. You had a hard-boiled egg. And it was actually on my list of questions. So I feel like there's so much conversation around what we eat, mm-hmm. our brain function, the mind-body connection. We're going to cover all of it. But what have you seen? What is your opinion? What are you eating personally? And what do you think about diets and how it affects our brain function?
So I think the whole idea of diet and the brain is really fascinating. What we now know, and we didn't even know this, I'd say 10 years ago, is, you know, we have sensors in our brain that sense how much we've eaten, kind of sense what we're eating, and how our body is metabolizing what we're eating. We used to believe that a lot of that was controlled primarily by the pancreas and the liver, some by the brain. But the brain really can sense in most individuals what you've eaten, you know, how full you are. There are receptors that actually go from the stomach and send signals up to the brain that say, you've eaten enough, in most people. And also,
mine might be faulty.
Well, I'm saying most people because many people who have true problems with weight don't have that sensation, don't have those receptors in the brain that are activated properly that let them know they're full. So they can never feel full.
Mm.
Okay, so while, you know, you may see someone who has, you know, markedly overweight and you'll think, gosh, you know, why are they that way? Well, their brain can never tell them they're full, so they always feel hungry. And wouldn't that be a really difficult place to be at? So in terms of, you know, nutrition, food, and the brain, so for one thing is the brain really has those sensors. You have eaten enough or you haven't. And then depending on the contents of what you eat, for example, if you eat a very, you know, high carbohydrate type of meal, the brain then initially gets flooded with a lot of high glucose. But then what happens frequently is then the glucose levels go down and the brain is dependent on glucose. So all of a sudden it's flooded with a lot. And you talk about children with sugar highs. It's because, oh my gosh, you know, all this sugar is in my brain. But then 30 minutes later, when the levels markedly go down because you have insulin release from the pancreas and then the blood sugar gets into your fat and muscle, then your brain is kind of like, oh, you know, I don't have enough energy at all. I think I'm going to go to sleep. So the brain is actually very interesting in that it responds to your glucose levels, responds to, you know, kind of normal. If you've got fairly normal protein and fat levels, the brain's fairly happy. It's your signal that you're hungry. It's your signal that you're full.
This is so interesting. I feel like I've been hearing more lately about diet relative to ADD and ADHD.
Yes.
I feel like it's mostly a conversation around gluten.
I know less about gluten. I'll be honest. I know less about gluten. I don't want to speak where I don't have knowledge. And, you know, there are truly people who cannot eat gluten. Mm-hmm. You know, people truly have celiac disease and have antibodies that don't allow them to process gluten. Now, how much of the other data or kind of speak that's out there about gluten, ADD, the brain, I think some of it's fairly soft science at this point. Better studies need to be done in terms of gluten and the brain.
Mm. See, I don't eat gluten and I have Hashimoto's, you know, in my thyroid.
Right.
And someone along the way said you shouldn't eat gluten if you have Hashimoto's. So I said, okay. And I cut out gluten and generally felt pretty good. I'm not sure if it's because I'm eating less gluten-free or if it's because I'm eliminating a lot of the junk foods that are in gluten, right? A lot of the carbs, right? So
where we started this discussion was, as I mentioned, you know, high glucose, which is, you know, high carbs, those high dense carbs, you know, can initially give you, make you feel all right, you know, for the first 30 minutes, but then give you that that's somewhat low.
So what do you think of elimination diets like keto that's so popular right now, where people are cutting out carbs completely or cutting out sugar, or people who are focusing on one area?
Yeah, so the best diet for sure is a diet that isn't of any extreme, right? Mm. So you have, you know, it's a fairly high protein, you know, moderate lipid, moderate carbohydrate, and complex carbohydrates too, not the really refined sugars. So that's the best diet, what's called the Mediterranean diet. So any of the extremes are interesting. So for example, the keto diet, where you have absolutely no carbohydrates, right? So you become ketotic. What does that mean? You have something called ketone bodies, which are just big, and their bodies, I mean, they look like it in your blood, and when you see it, and they're just like these circles of fat that are now the sources of energy for you and for your brain. So people who become very ketotic, overly ketotic, actually don't think clearly.
Mm.
Okay, that's what ketosis is. You can actually have ketotic coma, where, you know, that's the extreme. That's rare. That's probably not possible just by diet. You have to be a diabetic to have a ketotic coma, but that can occur. And you become extremely thirsty, as you know, if you're on a ketotic diet, a ketone type diet. So that's an extreme. And so you need some carbohydrates, but probably a modest amount. And then there's the same, any of the really extreme diets are probably not particularly healthy.
Mm-hmm. So when we've gone out to dinner and we're together, you know, just as girlfriends, I'm also watching what you're eating because I adore you and I want to see how Eva Feldman eats, and you eat a very balanced diet. And it's kind of been reassuring to me because it can all feel very overwhelming, very confusing. We all want to feel well. We all want to think clearly. We've all had moments, you know, hey, listen, I'm 46. I feel like the brain fog comes a little more frequently than I would like, but that's, you know, I also have four little boys and one big boy, right?
Boys to take care of in my book, yes.
So we're all trying to be our best self, and we don't know to what extent we can control it with diet or supplements or...
Yeah, one thing I think is important, since we're talking about food, is some of the pollutants that are currently in foods. I think that's important. I think, you know, I have this interest in the environment, in both climate change and the environment, and how it actually affects our health. So, you know, what you put in your mouth, you know, what you breathe, what you touch, you know, are extremely important for brain health and for brain integrity. So, for example, there are, you know, you probably heard of, like, you know, the dirty dozen in terms of vegetables and fruits that are not organic. And we call them the dirty dozen because, depending on how they've been treated, you know, they've been treated with pesticides or other pollutants, that when you ingest those, what we have found and shown, that there's an increased prevalence of those metabolites of pesticides in the blood of patients who develop Lou Gehrig's disease. It's also been shown in patients with Parkinson's disease and in patients with Alzheimer's disease. So the brain doesn't like toxins or pollutants. And so I think it's important when we're talking about what we put in our mouth to also think, you know, if, you know, hopefully you have the resources to actually think and buy organic if you can, because it's less likely to have the pollutants or to have been treated with chemicals that can be bad for you. Bad for your brain, bad for how you think, but also I think bad for, you know, your longevity and your ability to be disease free.
Well, I mean, and it really makes so much sense, right? You're talking about chemicals.
You know, pesticides. I mean, you have to understand, for example, DDT, if you've heard of that, that was the most prevalently used pesticide in the 70s here in the United States. It was outlawed. It's still used in India, for example, as a pesticide. We have shown in our own research that the number one metabolite of DDT is something called DDE, okay? And we see that in the blood of patients who have neurodegenerative diseases.
Wow.
Okay, and then we don't necessarily see much of it in the individuals who don't. So that's important, you know, so what you put. And the other thing that's interesting is we've talked about feeling full and not feeling full. So those individuals who do have the ability to control the amounts they eat, it's important not to be obese, if possible, not to let your weight get out of control, because what is also known is there's a doubling of cognitive impairment with obesity. So exactly why that is occurring, we don't yet know, But also, if you have type 2 diabetes, you're 2 times more likely to develop Alzheimer's disease. We now know those things. So, you know, there's a close association between how the brain is functioning and, you know, the nutrients that are available to the brain.
Let's go back to the very beginning.
Yes.
How did you become interested in the brain?
Wow. Okay. Great question. I always wanted to know. I always knew I wanted to be a physician, even when I was really little. Well, maybe I was indoctrinated by my Jewish, you know, heritage, but I always know. But I went.
And did you have any physicians in your family?
No, I'm the very first one.
Oh, interesting.
One and only. Well, one and only for my generation.
And how many siblings do you have?
So I'm the oldest of 5, but 2 of my 3 children are doctors. I think you know that. Mm-hmm. So I've passed it down.
And 2 lawyers?
1 lawyer.
Oh, okay.
So I have 3. So 1 lawyer, 2 doctors of my 3 children. And then I have 2 stepchildren. I have a physical therapist and a social worker. Mm, so there
okay.
we go. So
yeah.
We always say we're full service, mm-hmm. right? We've got, you know, from legal to physical therapy to an internist. And then my youngest son's becoming a psychiatrist, which is kind of interesting. But anyway, back to me. I went to college relatively young. And one of the first courses I took was a neuroscience course.
Well, when did you start college?
I was 16 when I started
16.
College.
16?
Yeah. And so I took this course in neuroscience I knew nothing about. And I thought, wow, isn't this interesting? And so I ended up just loving neuroscience, loving the brain, loving the nervous system, and realizing that's what I wanted to do.
Well, let me go back again. Did you always love learning? What were you like as a child? Were you always reading? Were you?
Well, so I had a very interesting childhood in that my mother's born and raised in Italy and came here. And she and my father knew each other for 3 weeks and got married. And that was in New York City. So I was born in the Bronx. And then what my mother did was toggle back and forth. So I grew up in Rome. Okay.
I didn't know that. So do you still speak Italian?
Yes, I do speak Italian. I understand it beautifully, but my accent is fairly bad now. But so I grew up, you know, kind of toggling back and forth. And so in a way, the reason I went to college young is I would come back to the United States. And what grade was she in? We don't know. So throw her in this grade. I go to Italy. What grade is she in? Well, we don't know. Throw her in this grade. So I always loved to learn. And I was very fortunate, right? Because in Italy, you know, I would tour Europe all the time. And then I'd come back here to the States. And I had very loving grandparents and my father. And so I was always really encouraged to learn. So there was, you know, the Jewish part of the family and the Italian Catholic part of the family. And everybody had the same kind of ethos, which was, you know, a very loving, caring environment where learning was really emphasized a great deal.
And so then you fall in love with the brain.
Fell in love with the brain. And then that was it. I did my bachelor's and then I did my MD, PhD at the University of Michigan. And my PhD is in neurochemistry, chemistry of the brain. And then after I finished my MD at U of M, I did my neurology residency at Johns Hopkins University, which was a wonderful, wonderful learning experience. I really enjoyed it. And then came back to Michigan, came back to University of Michigan and have been there for 30 years.
And really much of your focus has been on ALS.
Yeah. So it's very interesting. I'm well known for that because of the clinical trials we've done. My research is actually in 3 areas. I've been always very interested in the complications of diabetes. If you talk to someone, not as much in the lay community, but in the scientific community, I'm probably better known for all of my research with diabetes and all its neurologic complications among the scientists. And then we've also done a lot of work on Lou Gehrig's disease, trying to understand not only what causes it, but always trying to develop treatments. With the complications of diabetes, we spend a lot of time trying to understand the why, the very basic scientific why. With ALS, and maybe that's the reason we're better known in the community for ALS, we spent a lot of time saying, we're not going to figure out why someone gets ALS. We're working on it, but we don't think we're going to crack that nut. So let's try to develop new therapeutics. So that's why we've done 2 stem cell trials. And as interestingly, I was on the phone yesterday. We're going to call a meeting to do the 3rd stem cell trial. So it's been a long time coming.
For our listeners, help us understand a little bit more about stem cell and research and treatments.
Sure. So at the University of Michigan, you can have a position like mine where you see patients 1 day a week and the other 3 to 4 days a week, or 1 to 2 days a week, and the other 3 to 4 days a week, you run a basic science laboratory. And that's what I do. I'm called a clinician scientist. And it's really wonderful. Actually, I'm completely blessed to have this position because I go and I see patients, right? And then I'm the bridge in a way that brings an understanding of the disease back to the basic science laboratory, where we spend time trying to understand what causes the disease, how can we develop new therapeutics. So we have, for example, for Lou Gehrig's disease, we're very interested on understanding the role of the environment in causing Lou Gehrig's disease, because as I know, I've told you, Michigan has the highest prevalence of Lou Gehrig's disease of any state in the United States. So I'm very interested in understanding that piece.
Why is that? What are you finding in the environment?
Well, I mean, one of the reasons, I believe, is we're both an industrial and an agricultural state. Mm-hmm. And so, again, this comes back to our interest in the climate and environment. And we see in our patients with ALS 5 times higher level of pesticides, for example, than we see in those individuals who don't have ALS. So, and we have in Michigan 65 unclean Superfund sites, which is a tragedy, actually, for this wonderful state of ours. So, you know, so I'm very interested in that aspect of ALS. But in parallel, because I direct the ALS Center of Excellence at the University of Michigan, and I see these patients. This week, I've diagnosed 3 new people with ALS. 2 weeks ago, there were 6 people in my clinic with new diagnoses of ALS. So, you know, I see a lot of it clinically, so I want to come up with new therapeutics. So we tried. I spent 10 years of my career doing a clinical trial with a growth factor called insulin-like growth factor 1, IGF-1. We did a really large phase 1, phase 2, and phase 3 clinical trial, and it did not work. And I was sure it was going to. Oh, my gosh. So the day I got those data, I literally put my head down on the desk and cry, something I rarely do for about 30 minutes. And I thought, well, you know, gather yourself. What are you going to do? And I called up the dean and said, you know, I'm going to take a 3-month sabbatical. I'm going to go to California. This was 10 years ago. And I'm going to learn about stem cells. I said, I've got a disease here that isn't going to respond to just one drug. So let me see if I can learn about stem cells and try stem cell therapy in ALS. So that's the origin of wanting to do stem cells, is everything else we had tried had failed. And so what we've shown is if we transplant, these are true transplantations of stem cells in the spinal cord, either in the neck area or the low back area of patients who have ALS, these stem cells surround what are sick nerve cells in ALS and nurse them back to health. And the patients have an increased mobility. The patients likely have increased survival. We've done 2 clinical trials. We need to do what's called a registration trial or the pivotal trial, the last trial. And it appears now that the company that's helped us all along has received the finances to allow us to move forward. So we have a meeting in October.
And what other types of diseases
might respond to stem cells? Well, you know, the classic, of course, that is responding now beautifully are, you know, are the blood diseases, leukemia. Mm-hmm. So you do a stem cell transplant for a patient who has leukemia, it's a cure now. I mean, we can cure leukemia. When I started medical school, it was a fatal disease.
I mean, just that in and of itself, Eva. I mean, just to be able to say we have a cure for leukemia, it takes my breath away.
Yeah, I mean, it's amazing, actually. So stem cells, there's a lot of hype about stem cells, and there's a lot of what I call stem cell tourism, where stem cells are being used inappropriately. That's important to know, too. And that's really not good, but people are enamored of stem cells. What's being tried now and are in clinical trials for stem cells are stem cells use in stroke, in Parkinson's disease, in ALS, we hope. There is a current stem cell trial in ALS being done in California. Stem cells are in clinical trial to replace damaged heart tissue, clinical trials, and also to replace damaged cartilage, clinical trials, where it's yet to be proven. The big home run are the stem cell transplants now for leukemia, for myeloma, another bone disease. I mean, these stem cell transplants cure patients.
And how about in Alzheimer's?
So glad you asked, actually, because we have a grant from the National Institutes of Aging to take our preclinical work, meaning our work with animal models of Alzheimer's, into a larger animal model, into man. So my hope is within 2 years to be doing the phase 1 FDA trial of stem cell transplants for Alzheimer's. And it's actually not as aggressive in many ways as our ALS trials to put stem cells in the spinal cord. If you feel the back of your neck, you feel mm-hmm. those bones, mm-hmm. right? So we got to go through those. We have to take those bones off mm-hmm. in order to do a stem cell transplant in the spinal cord. But for the brain, we actually take a little dental drill and make just a teeny little hole in the scalp, you know, in the skull. And then you can take a thin needle and direct the stem cells. So it's much less invasive, much easier to do. And there's a lot of work right now, you know, with deep brain stimulation, putting electrodes in the brain for Parkinson's disease and for essential tremors, et cetera. So we have a lot of experience doing that. It can be done under MR guidance. So it's much less invasive. And it's exciting because the preclinical work is very positive. So I can cure Alzheimer's disease in a mouse. Now, you know, there's a pretty big difference between a mouse and a man. But, you know, that's really the first step. And there are, you know, there are clear steps you have to take, which I'm a big believer in, that we're highly regulated by the FDA before we actually go to man. But we're on that road. Is we're funded by the National Institutes of Aging. So your tax dollars are actually, you know, paying for this work to try to find new ways to address Alzheimer's disease. So, I mean, I think what's important to know is that Alzheimer's is a clear epidemic in this country. Diabetes is a clear epidemic in this country. And you put the two together and it's really very, very frightening. There are estimated between probably 6 to 8 million people that have Alzheimer's now. And it's just logarithmically increasing. 30 million people right now in the U.S. with diabetes, 80 million with pre-diabetes. And most of those will go on to have diabetes. So, you know, you put those numbers together and you look at long-term health, and it's really, these are problems we need to address. We cannot, as a community, ignore these problems.
So what can we do to be proactive at every stage of our life? So, you know, 15 years ago, I started a program for kids that's now focused on mindfulness and wellness. And we're working with, we've now worked with, I think, 16,000 kids in Detroit, and we're really yoga focused now. It's yoga and nutrition. And we give them a safe space or a sacred space to be still in a safe environment.
I love that program. You know that.
Oh, I know you. Thank you. And you've always been so supportive. And as you know, running a nonprofit and having to ask for donations, and when you're a 501c3, you can't just fund it yourself and you have to be out asking people. And, you know, as you know, there were many years where I would be talking to people and they didn't quite get it. And it would just be Danielle's yoga thing, right? And for me, what really started, even going back before we became yoga based, was, you know, being a news junkie and reading the papers every day before I had kids. You know, my favorite part of the day before kids, Pete and I would you know, read all of our newspapers and have our coffee. But I was reading every day about this epidemic of childhood obesity.
Oh, it's huge.
And I was, you know, observing, and I was reading about all of these different programs that were treating kids from the outside in, right? And, you know, just get them to run on a field. Well, that's not actually getting to the root of the problem,
exactly.
Right? And I thought, what if we could treat them not, you know, listen, I'm not an expert on any of this. I just thought, what if we approached it differently and tried to treat them from the inside out? And for people who didn't really understand this, you know, Danielle's nutrition yoga thing, I thought, okay, but everyone tends to understand the bottom line, right? And I started saying 15 years ago, you know, and I understand why people are kind of looking at me going, what do you know? But it seemed to me that if we're talking about this epidemic of childhood obesity, and there is so much evidence that it leads to preventable cancers, heart disease, and diabetes, right? And I said, maybe everyone, if they're not, you know, looking at kids and their hearts aren't breaking, maybe they'll hear these numbers and be horrified thinking about the healthcare costs that our community is going to incur with these preventable diseases.
Right. I mean, I can't agree with you more, as you know. And the issue is that there aren't enough programs like your program. In California now, 15% of children under the age of 5 are obese. Not overweight, but obese. The most common diagnoses that are being made now in diabetic clinics are diagnosing teenagers with type 2 diabetes. Particularly, I will tell you, teenagers from minority populations and from our more diverse populations, because, you know, their source of food is this high caloric, dense food. They're not encouraged to exercise. Well-being is not encouraged. The idea of actually thinking about being well, doing yoga, you know, eating correctly is not part necessarily of their ethos.
Well, you know, and it was, what was so interesting is when we introduced yoga at just one of our sessions, not intending to become yoga focused, the kids were so excited, Eva. It was like I brought in a rock star,
right.
Like I brought in a rap star. They were jumping up and down, begging us to come back. I still have goosebumps when I think about it. And we were stunned. And then I thought, wait, it's not shocking. We all want to feel good, right?
Right.
Like I said earlier, we're giving them a chance to be still in a safe environment. And we're talking about kids that typically can't go out and just run around the block because there are issues with stray dogs, right? For them, we have to be very intentional because a lot of the kids we are working with, maybe going to McDonald's is a special treat. Maybe that's when they're spending time with a special family member, right? So we want to be very careful of not judging them, but teaching them. And we would use test tubes a lot to show them how much sugar is in a can of Coke. And like I said, they want to feel well too, right?
Yes, exactly.
And when they started to calculate and they can and say, oh my gosh, I can recognize that I don't feel good after I have a can of Coke. And oh my goodness, that's how much sugar is in. Well, you know what? The next time I go to McDonald's, maybe I'll choose a bottle of water over a Coke and maybe I'll get the apple slices instead of the French fries.
Exactly. So, well, no, I mean, we have to start young. I mean, that's, you know, kind of where we started talking a few minutes ago. You wanted to know at every stage of life. I mean, the younger you can teach, the sooner, I should say, you can teach a young person, you know, wellness, good habits, exercise, you know, daily exercise is extremely, extremely important. There are endless studies now that show that routine exercise, which is just, for example, for an adult walking 30 minutes five times a week, is protective for the brain, encourages and enhances brain health.
Okay, so I just have to go back and say that again for all of our listeners who are going, wait, what did she just say?
Okay.
30 minutes five times a week actually creates a protective, it's protective for the brain.
It is clearly protective for the brain. It definitely allows you to retain cognition longer. It helps. It's brain health. What we can see in animal models, we haven't shown this in patients, is what it does is, you know, everybody has adult stem cells in all your organs. It actually causes birth. Exercise causes birth of adult stem cells in the brain. So one thing you're doing when you're walking that 30 minutes is you're actually generating your own new stem cells in the brain. But you're also, you know, improving the metabolism of your brain cells. So exercise, I can't emphasize enough how important. And it doesn't have to be, you don't have to, I mean, I'm not a triathlete or a marathon runner, you know, and I can't like stand on, you know, my head and do all those, you know, I have none of the extremes at all. But, you know, if you can just do normal 30 minutes of brisk walking is all one needs five times a week as an adult. And as a child, really, you probably don't need more than that either. But to encourage physical activity in children is really, really important for the brain.
So someone was telling me the other day that she was watching or reading about Rita Moreno, the actress, who I think is 87 and very sharp, and she credits it with walking backwards 2 miles a day.
Yes. Okay. So
is this true? Or brushing, people should brush their teeth with their opposite hand because it resets your brain.
Well, that's
so
really
Eva,
interesting.
Does it?
so it's really interesting. I will say that, for example, in China, in Asian cultures, I didn't know, because Rita Moreno is, you know, I guess, you know, Hispanic. I don't know if it's true in Hispanic cultures, but for example, when you go to China, you'll see all the elderly adults walking backwards. They do Tai Chi in the morning, and then rather than taking their walk forward, many of them take their walks backwards. Does it reset the brain? I actually don't know the answer to that question, I'll be honest. But I will tell you that anything you can do in terms of increasing your physical activity is good for brain health. I take the kind of key take-home points of brain health are, we can start with physical activity if we want to, physical activity. Nutrition, which we've, I think, discussed, avoiding pollutants. And then we haven't really had a chance and probably won't at this sitting to talk about, you know, trying to live a balanced life. You've mentioned yoga, trying to not put yourself in situations where you're in really extremes, whether it be extreme distress, you know, extreme fear, any of the extremes.
So I wanted to ask you about that as well. So as I was, you know, researching and preparing for this interview, and I was thinking about the mind-body connection, and I was thinking about, you know, mental health. And generally, I have always thought of mental health as being kind of our emotional well-being, right? And for some reason, it's so obvious, I'd never kind of looked at mental as your mind, right? And that really our emotional health is really coming from our brain, right? And so all these pieces, I was kind of having all these aha moments. I learned something every time I'm with you. Just learning about you, I'm learning more things. So what do you think are the best tools for minimizing or managing stress? Is it mindfulness? Is it meditation?
Certainly, I mean, certainly mindfulness and meditation are extremely important. If you can identify the stressors, okay, I think, you know, to alleviate or take away the stressors at any level is extremely important. And sometimes you can't do that yourself, but someone from the outside can come in and say, oh, you know, you're stressed because your schedule is too hectic or because there's really no infrastructure or structure to your life. You know, things that can be fixed. But it's also important to know that a lot of individuals have chemical imbalances in their brain, right? You know, you can have blonde hair, blue eyes, for example, and that's how you look. And then the same way the brain can have some neurons that are misfiring, or you can have high serotonin, low serotonin, too much dopamine. You know, it's something you can inherit. Mm-hmm. And so when you inherit chemical imbalances in the brain, that's when it's important to, and you always feel, for example, stressed or always feel anxious regardless of your surroundings and regardless of what you do, then you likely have a true chemical imbalance in your brain that then needs to be addressed. And there are good medications to address that.
And so you feel that it's manageable if you're on the right meds.
Yeah, then you need to go to your family physician. He'll probably refer you to a psychiatrist. And that's the specialty that really understands chemical imbalances. The way diabetes is too much sugar, you know, in your body. You know, you can have anxiety that can be too much serotonin in your brain. And so they're also, you know, clear brain diseases that can be treated that are due to chemical imbalances that we may think, oh, that person's just anxious. Oh, that person's always stressed out. Mm. But actually, that person has a primary brain disorder. There are also situational, you know, stressors, and that's what we started talking about. That's what we have to think about. You know, if you're feeling stressed or anxious and it's more situational, then you really do need to try to address the situation. And your body reacts to that, right? You've got an autonomic nervous system. Mm-hmm. You know, you have sympathetic surges. You get high levels of these hormones, norepinephrine, epinephrine. Your heart races. You feel anxious. You get flushed. Mm-hmm. That's your body's reaction to stressful situations.
And with the chemical imbalance, there is that fine line. Some people, we could say it's just the way they're wired.
Mm-hmm.
Other people truly need the meds and they truly need to be diagnosed.
Yes, they do. And it's really important.
For anyone who's listening and is very specifically thinking of someone they love or someone they care about, it's a very fragile situation, right? Something you'd probably want to approach delicately depending on who you're thinking of or want to talk to. And what would be the next step? Would it be getting them to a psychiatrist? And how is it actually diagnosed?
Yeah, I mean, I think a good first step is just talking, having them speak to their family doctor. Okay, their internist, their family medicine physician, whoever they get any sort of medical care from. And that family physician will then refer them appropriately, because most physicians will be able to understand if it is due to a chemical imbalance versus outside stressors. So if you have, you know, a clear situational stress, you know, there's a death in the family, a child is ill, you've undergone a divorce. I mean, those are clear situational stressors that then you know someone is going to need assistance and care, but it's not a chemical imbalance where someone every single day, regardless of what occurs, you know, is stressed or anxious.
I mean, the brain is just, as you know, so fascinating, right? And there's so much around it. And, you know, I'm also thinking about our brain and how it's affected and kids and screen time. And
oh, yes. Oh.
And I feel, and I say often, I feel like we are in the Wild West in terms of the extent of impact on development.
I agree with you.
Our brain. And, you know, I felt with my own kids very strongly during what I believe is the formative years and the first few years of their life, not giving them access to screen time. But, you know, listen, I have four kids. By the time the fourth came along, you know,
right,
it's
I know.
A little bit more. It's a little bit more with each one. But, you know, for me, and by no means do I have it all figured out. And, you know, hey, listen, I'm just a mom. We're all trying to do the best we can. But I know for me and Pete, as parents, our priorities are empathy, right? And their social development. We say we want them to be good conversationalists.
Right.
We want them to be able to look people in the eye.
Right.
Beyond just saying please and thank you, which of course we all want for our kids, right? We want them to actually be engaging and
exactly.
engaged. But that having empathy is absolutely a priority for both of us. And I worry in this day and age, as I said, I feel like we're in the Wild West, because it seems to me that having access to so much screen time is probably affecting brain makeup.
Oh, it is. It is. There's no data.
And a world without empathy is to me the scariest thing in the world.
Well, I mean, a world without individuals who can socially interact. So now there are studies you know, large studies done by, you know, I mean, so now there are data to support the fact that if a child, you know, from age 2 to 3 on up interacts only with a device and really doesn't have true social interaction, those children are miswired.
So it actually is affecting their brain.
It is actually affecting their brain. It's actually affecting their development. And it's actually affecting their ability to socially interact. So the idea that, you know, you're talking about empathy, and, you know, I think your definition of empathy is someone who can sit down and have a conversation with you.
You know, it's so important to be able to qualify what is our definition of empathy.
I mean, you want someone who feels,
who
understands,
feels, right,
and who can communicate.
Yes, and who feels someone else's pain when they're struggling.
And when your main source of social interaction is an iPad or a phone, an iPhone, then you don't develop those feelings. So I am, oh my gosh, I'm so against all the screen stuff. You know, it can be used for teaching, mm-hmm, right? I mean, mm-hmm, it has,
sure,
clear educational purposes. It's certainly part of our society. But when I go to a restaurant, I mean, how many times do you go to a restaurant, Danielle, and you see that two parents are on their iPhones and their children, ages 3 on up,
yeah,
everybody's on their iPhones. No one is actually speaking to each other.
Mm.
And what, I mean, and so if the parents so choose, well, at least they were raised minus the iPhones,
right,
but they're not interacting with their children.
You know, as you know, parenting is so hard and kids are exhausting, right?
Yes, they
but
are.
It is true. When we're at restaurants and you look around and you see kids starting, I mean, really, I would say I often see kids, babies who are under a year with an iPad in front of them, right? The truth is, it seems that most kids, if they don't have the option of an iPad, right? It's not even about taking an iPad away is like taking candy from a baby,
right?
Of course, they're not going to be happy. But if they believe they don't have the option of an iPad and they just have to color, I think they're generally fine with it.
Oh, yeah. Oh, they like it.
Trying to talk to kids is hard. You know, we all know if you've been out of town and you call your kids to FaceTime or have a phone conversation, it's painful.
How are you? Fine. What did you do today? Everything's fine. Yeah.
You know,
no.
I don't know what girls are like. I know boys don't really tell you anything. But I feel like, you know, when you're in a restaurant, and like I said, it can be so difficult. If you give kids just a placemat and crayons, they're actually going to be okay. Right.
Oh, yeah.
And
no, it's much better for them. Play tic-tac-toe with them.
Play tic-tac-toe.
You know, I mean, do something with them. You know, play hangman if they can. Interact with your children. Don't let your children grow up interacting with an electronic device. That's in terms of brain health, because I can tell we're almost out of time here. In terms of brain health,
yeah,
for your children, that's probably, again, of course, nutrition, sleep. We haven't talked about sleep. Sleep is so important.
Yeah, let's talk about sleep.
Well, are we out of time?
Yeah, we'll be okay.
Okay. Well, let's talk about sleep for a minute. So nutrition, exercise, sleep, and then true social interactions. Not all of the screen time is just extremely important. Let's end with sleep. So let me tell you what we know now. This is all new news in the last 10 years. When you sleep at night, there has now been discovered, it's, oh my gosh, that we've only discovered them in the last 10 years. You know, there are literally what are like drains that drain your brain at night and drain your brain of all the chemical buildup you have during the day when you're awake. It is the analogy that's being used. I know. And most
There's
people
an actual
don't even
brain
know.
Brain drain.
There is an actual brain drain.
There's a literal brain
and
drain.
And sleep at night drains your brain of all the junk, I'll use just the word junk, a layman's term, but it's very darn accurate, of what you accumulate during the day. So if you are short on sleep, all that stuff is still in your brain.
How about naps? Do naps count?
Yeah, naps count. That's interesting. I don't know if as much data, because this is all new literature, as much data are available on like how effective naps are in terms of this. One of the main purposes now we know of sleep is to allow your brain to, I'll just use the word again, drain overnight. The analogy that people are using is, do you know how if you don't, for example, if you don't have kidneys, you develop toxins in your blood and you have to undergo dialysis, your blood is cleaned. Sleep is the dialysis of the brain every night. So sleep cleans your brain every night. You would not believe these pictures. Next time we're together, I'll bring you some.
Oh, I can't wait.
Pictures of, there are literally brain drains. And we just discovered them. How do you like that? Who knows then? To end, who knows what else there is?
I just have to ask you one more, because there's always one more. I know so much about the brain. But around, so we talked about kids and screen time, but what about adults and screen time?
So there aren't as much literature, because everything I'm telling you is, I'll say, evidence-based medicine. Mm-hmm. I'm not, you know, like when I couldn't answer the gluten questions, it's because I don't know the evidence. Mm-hmm. So there isn't a lot of evidence-based data on how continuous screen time affects adults. So I don't have the answer to that. All the studies have been done in children, and all the studies say it's the same thing. Continuous screen time in children is not beneficial for their brain or for their health.
So screen time, won't say bad, but not good. Sleep good. We all need more sleep.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Sleep is essential. My gosh, sleep is essential. The data have made me sleep more. I used to be one of these 5 hours a night people, you know, and now I've turned into a 7 hour a night person. You know, you have to almost train yourself to sleep if you're not used to it, but the data scared me.
So does it matter what kind of sleep you're getting? Does it need to be REM sleep? Does it need to be, like I've heard, you know, true sleep only happens when you're in a completely dark room. Like I like to sleep with, they have these great eye masks that are like little pods that go over your eyes. And I love it. Pete can sleep with all the lights on.
Right. Yeah. There are different stages of sleep and everybody goes through different stages of sleep. And so you need to be in select stages of sleep for so many hours. You know, there are four stages of sleep, and REM is the one that people know the most about. But as long as you're getting contiguous sleep and you're not being interrupted, that's why, for example, now we really, I know, have to stop. That's why sleep apnea is so bad for you, though, because what sleep apnea is doing is taking you out of sleep stages and putting you in that pre-sleep stage where you're not awake, but you're no longer in a good stage of sleep.
And the brain's not draining.
I will also tell you, because you're also not breathing, Your blood pressure goes up, your oxygenation goes down. Sleep apnea is actually a very important medical problem, very important to the brain that your sleep apnea is treated.
Eva, I want to pick your brain forever.
I know, we could sit here and talk forever.
I love you so much. I love spending time with you. You have to come back because I think I only made a small dent in all the questions I had for you.
And thank you for all you've done. Let me end by telling you, thank you for all you've done to help raise awareness. And again, that program that you are doing and have done with children, if we had, you know, 100 or 1,000 or thousands of those programs in this country, that's the preventative type of medicine that this country is begging for. So thank you, Danielle.
Oh, thank you. It means so much to me from you. Okay. Thank you, Eva.
This has been the Karma Has Spoken podcast. If you like today's content, feel free to share our show by email, social media, or any other means. If you've got a question, comment, or other feedback, visit our website at karmahasspoken.com. Keep up with us by subscribing to Karma Has Spoken in your favorite podcast app or follow Karma Has Spoken on social media. Karma Has Spoken is a production of JAG and Detroit Podcasts.